intelligence chief Tamir Heyman has admitted in an interview that Tel Aviv was involved in the January 2020 assassination of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, in a drone strike that also killed deputy chief of Iraq's popular mobilization unit, Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis, at Baghdad Airport. The headline, however, didn't come as a surprise given initial reports on the role of informants in tipping the CIA about the whereabouts of the Iranian general on the day of the U.S. drone strike. It's not the first time Israel has been involved in such operations against Iran either. The regime assassinated four Iranian scientists between 2010 and 2012. In November last year, Iran's top nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was assassinated in an attack that Iran says has Israel's fingerprints all over it. Tehran also points its finger at Tel Aviv for multiple sabotage attacks that have recently hit Iran's nuclear facilities in an abortive attempt to undermine the country's nuclear program. Despite Iran's repeated calls on the international community to hold the perpetrators responsible for the dangerous adventurism, neither the United Nations nor self-proclaimed promoters of human rights in the West have called for accountability or made any meaningful attempt to prevent similar attacks. That's also true about Israel's military action on nations like Syria and the regime's atrocities against the people of Palestine, all of which are considered as blatant violation of international law.
Because of the protection of the United States in the United Nations Security Council, flat out, this is what enables Israel to perpetuate its rogue activity regionally and globally, to perpetuate its terrorism, to perpetuate its ethnic cleansing and genocide against the Palestinian people, to continually bomb neighboring countries almost daily. It is the protection of the United States in the United Nations that enables Israel to act in this continually terroristic and scofflaw manner.
That begs the question, wouldn't the lack of international accountability legitimize Israel's state terrorism and embolden the regime to intensify its aggression?
The seventh round of the Vienna talks wrapped up on Friday with modest gains, and the negotiating teams are back home for a recess. Iran, China, Russia, France, Germany, and the UK, plus the US, which is participating indirectly, have held multiple rounds of talks to revive the 2015 deal, which the US abandoned in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. The sides are now working to reach an agreement on a joint text that would promise the removal of anti-Iran sanctions, the US's re-entry to the deal, and Iran's return to full compliance to the accord.
We have reached two agreed texts, which are the result of intensive rounds of talks over the past days in Vienna. The new texts incorporate Iran's positions in the previous discussions with the proposals of the new Iranian government. These texts lay the basis for moving the talks forward in the upcoming dialogues.
Tehran says in the first place it wants all sanctions imposed as part of the US's so-called maximum pressure campaign removed in a verifiable manner. Also, there must be a guarantee that the U.S. will not renege on the accord again. This seems to be a major roadblock, as the U.S. regards Iran's demands as maximalist. Tehran says its demands are nothing but its rights under the 2015 deal. Iran's foreign ministry described the U.S. behavior as, quote, symptoms of Alzheimer's, as it has forgotten the terms of the pact.
The U.S. must have forgotten that it was the one that arrogantly left the deal. When Mr. Trump discarded the accord and even threatened to punish any country that would keep its ties with Iran. So Washington is responsible for the current problems in the JCPOA, and if it wants to win the ticket back to the accord, the shortest possible path is to remove the sanction it's illegally imposed on Iran in a verifiable manner.
Iran and the P4 Plus One started the Vienna talks in April this year, during the previous Iranian government. The sixth round of the talks was the last in the Rouhani administration, and the seventh round began after a five-month hiatus, as Iran was forming its new team in the new Iranian administration.
The new Iranian negotiating team shares the same stance as the previous one. Iran wants all sanctions to be removed. Period. While there's still resistance on the part of the U.S. to accept Iran's demands, the negotiating parties are hopeful that in the next round of talks, a common ground can be reached. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
the largest international gathering on Afghanistan since the U.S. left the country in a chaotic situation. The extraordinary meeting of the OIC foreign ministers was convened in Islamabad to discuss the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. The meeting was attended by not just the OIC states, but permanent members of the UN Security Council, representatives of the UN agencies, and the international financial institutions. Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan called for the immediate help for the people of Afghanistan.
The point is that if the world does not act, this will be the biggest man-made crisis which is unfolding in front of us. The OIC, it's a big responsibility on us, because not only is it the situation in Afghanistan as it unfolds, but it's a religious duty to help them.
The UN Undersecretary General on Humanitarian Affairs presented a grim picture of the Afghan situation.
Basic services that all Afghans depend on are collapsing as international development support, upon which the country has depended for so long, has frozen up. By the middle of next year, as estimated by UNDP, universal poverty may reach 97%.
The Iranian foreign minister proposed the establishment of a special fund to help the people of Afghanistan. He also called for the national reconciliation and inclusive government in Afghanistan. This was the second extraordinary meeting of the OIC on Afghanistan. The first one was also held in Islamabad 41 years ago, but the agenda at that time was to penalize the Soviet-backed regime in Kabul.
The meeting of the OIC foreign ministers came against the backdrop of worsening humanitarian situation in Afghanistan. According to the United Nations, nearly 23 million Afghans are facing acute food shortage. 97% of Afghan population could slip below the poverty line by June next year if urgent steps are not taken to mitigate their sufferings.
The acting Afghan foreign minister was also invited to the meeting. Officials say at this stage the priority is to avert the humanitarian crisis, and the question of recognition of the Taliban rule will come later. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Anger was vented outside Downing Street Sunday as Britain's ethnic minorities demanded the government scrap the controversial new Nationality and Border Bill. The bill gifts the state new powers to remove citizenship without warning or a proper appeal process. Black, Asian, and immigrant families are all expected to be targeted disproportionately by the new law change, sending fear ricocheting through communities.
Basically, what they're saying is that all that we've been working for as organizations, as generations of Muslims who exist in this country, belong to this country, whatever you've done doesn't really matter. You're a second-class citizen. And that is a dangerous narrative that they're presenting us with.
The fact that even though you're a British citizen, you're still affected if you're still from an ethnic minority country. So the fact that you're a member of the Sikh community, Muslim community, Hindu community, Black community, you're not really safe here.
As members of the public, as just citizens of Britain, we are just pawns, mere pawns to them in their political games. Our lives are at stake, and that is not an exaggeration.
Despite government reassurances, critics have warned that the new bill could affect an estimated 6 million Britons who were born elsewhere or have a second nationality, and could be used by the state to punish minority citizens they want to get rid of.
The bill has already passed through the House of Commons at its third reading earlier this month. It's now been passed onto the House of Lords, where it will be debated further on January the 5th. The result of that debate could determine whether so many British citizens, particularly from ethnic minorities, can maintain their nationality going forward. Robert Carter, London.
An investigation into the confidential documents of the U.S. military has laid bare horrifying facts about the American air war in West Asia. The New York Times says it has reviewed more than 1,300 records drawn from a hidden Pentagon archive. and all that has shed more light on how U.S. airstrikes have resulted in thousands of civilian deaths in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, but have gone mostly underreported. Based on the U.S. military's own count, air raids have killed some 1,600 civilians in these countries over the past years. And even though the Times does not give a figure, it does say that the military has drastically undercounted the tally. A particular case that's been highlighted is a 2016 attack on a hamlet in northern Syria that the U.S. military is said killed 85 Daesh terrorists. But as it turned out later, the victims were in fact 120 farmers and villagers. The high number of civilian deaths also hints at the deeply flawed intelligence plaguing the U.S. bombing campaign, as well as the hasty and imprecise targeting that is in sharp contrast to precision bombs and eagle-eyed drones propagated by the U.S. military. It also brings into question the Pentagon's claims of transparency and accountability. Based on the report, only a few assessments of faulty raids have been made public, and surprisingly, none have found any wrongdoing or led to disciplinary action. A more recent example is the U.S. drone strike that took the lives of 10 members of an Afghan family, seven of them children, in Kabul back in August. The Pentagon initially claimed that terrorists had been killed. Then it was forced to admit that the attack had been a tragic mistake, taking civilian lives. But eventually, it decided that no one would be punished for the erroneous strike. The New York Times says it has visited nearly 100 casualty sites in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan, and interviewed scores of survivors to compile the report. Even though many civilian survivors now have to live with disabilities that require expensive treatment, only fewer than a dozen have received compensation. Despite such a terrible record, the U.S. keeps up with its air campaigns mostly in Muslim nations. Scott Bennett, a former U.S. Army officer, believes it is time the international community moved to stop the U.S. war machine from spilling more innocent blood.
When is the world going to stand up and stop allowing the U.S. to call every other nation a state sponsor of terrorism and say that the United States is indeed the state sponsor of terrorism globally because it is engaged in the destruction of the world? When is the world going to stand up and tell the truth?
The U.S. Army carried out more than 50,000 airstrikes in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan between 2014 and 2019. The aim was allegedly to eliminate militants and terrorists and bring peace and stability to those countries. But those bombardments brought nothing other than death and destruction. And the U.S. has kept killing civilians with impunity and without accountability.
Yemen's capital Sana'a has hosted an exhibition on those who have lost their lives in the fight against the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. Thousands of Yemenis have visited the exhibition, which was held in the occasion of Yemen's Martyrs Week. The organizers of the exhibition highlighted the importance of unity among resistance groups in the region in the face of U.S.-backed aggressions.
The sacrifices made by these martyrs are great, and they came to end the injustice of the Yemeni people, and they are also a source of inspiration for various people to stand in the face of the invaders, and all the resistance groups should unite against the aggressors. Our martyrs stood against the invaders led by the United States and Israel and their Saudi and Emirati tools who seek to plunder Yemenis' wealth. The martyrs are from all segments of society, and this is evidence of the sincerity of the cause that they died to defend, and Yemenis learned from this occasion the values of great sacrifice.
The Saudi-led war on Yemen, which started in March 2015, has killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children. The war has taken a heavy toll on the country's infrastructure and pushed the war-torn country to the brink of famine.
People who say they will never forget the sacrifices made by those who stood up and defended their country against the Saudi aggression till their last breath. They say Riyadh's war crimes will not go unpunished and Saudi Arabia will be brought to justice for its atrocities. Abdulatif Loshali, Sana'a.
Afghanistan's health system is on the brink of collapse, partly due to Western sanctions imposed against the Taliban. Authorities say the sources needed to produce oxygen for coronavirus patients have run out, so as the supplies of many essential drugs. Hospital workers are struggling with acute shortages, while they have not been paid for months.
The
U.S. sanctions against the Islamic Emirate now mean sanctioning the Afghan people. When the health sector doesn't receive enough support, and Afghanistan's assets are not freed, people's daily life becomes difficult and health services would collapse. My demand as an Afghan doctor from world countries, especially those who have blocked our assets, is that they should have a look at the economic and medical situation of the people of Afghanistan and free the money. If the US has a problem with the Taliban, it must be solved through talks rather than by pressuring our patients.
With the winter coming, hospitals will receive more patients. But nowadays, nothing is free for them, and they hardly can afford to buy food and medicines.
Before the Taliban takeover, we used to receive food and medicines, but since the Taliban have taken power, there is no food, neither for patients nor for doctors. There are a few medicines available here, but doctors say most of them have already run out.
As I witnessed, first of all, most of the doctors were absent. It is said that they are disappointed because they have been unpaid for months. Second, the hospital rooms are very cold. In addition, there is a shortage of food and medicines. Patients share their food with hospital staff. It is world countries' duties to send humanitarian assistance to the Afghan health centers.
After the Taliban took over, the U.S. froze some $10 billion in assets of the Afghan Central Bank. The White House last week dismissed an immediate release of the money. The freezing of Afghan assets by the U.S. has dragged Afghanistan into hunger and the health crisis. Afghans said they have been harmed by sanctions imposed against the Taliban. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Migration, an ongoing phenomenon, seems to be endless. Countries around the world have always had to deal with migrants coming from various destinations. A broad range of factors contribute to the movement of people, including economic challenges, extreme poverty, or conflict. According to the United Nations, around 281 million people were international migrants in 2020. That represents 3.6% of the global population. In recent years, the wave of migration has taken a different turn as Europe and the United States have become the main destinations for migrants. Large numbers of people have tried to reach Europe from countries in West Asia, including Iraq and Syria, both witnessing wars in which the U.S. and some Western states have played a big role. The U.S. itself has faced a growing number of asylum seekers trying to reach there from Central American countries. The root causes for that include economic crises blamed on U.S. policies towards these countries. Migration has also become a source of political tensions among countries, with the latest examples in Europe. Belarus and neighboring Poland are at odds over the situation of thousands of migrants stranded at the border. The UK and France have also locked horns over the rising number of migrants trying to cross the English Channel into Britain. All this comes as many migrants lose their lives through their perilous journey. There have been other destinations for migrants too. Iran is one of them. It hosts Afghans fleeing poverty and conflict triggered by two decades of the US-led military presence in Afghanistan that came to an end just this past August. Several millions of Afghans currently live in Iran, which, according to the UN, make one of the largest refugee populations. The world body has on various occasions hailed Iran for accepting the Afghan refugees. All in all, experts believe the global migration crisis can only be tackled through a concerted effort by countries and enough determination to end conflicts across the world.
In the limelight.
Silicon Valley has become infamous for its role in the surveillance ecosystem, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Sam Knight, writer. This article is published under the heading, Apple Employee Blows Whistle on Illegal Spying and Toxic Working Conditions. Stay tuned for more. Silicon Valley has become infamous for its role in the surveillance ecosystem, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. Bosses are increasingly using an array of tech industry tools to keep constant tabs on their employees working from home, despite statistics showing that those who work remotely are more productive than their counterparts toiling away in office buildings. But one woman who worked for the tech industry's biggest company is fighting back. Ashley Giowick, a former Apple project manager who was fired in September after speaking out about workplace safety concerns, has asked labor regulators to rule that the company employs illegal surveillance tactics. In October, Giowick filed a complaint with the National Labor Relations Board, NLRB, accusing Apple of a number of unfair labor practices, including keeping tabs on employees in a manner that prevents them from exercising their right to discuss working conditions. Giowick also alleged that the company violated the National Labor Relations Act, NLRA, by retaliating against her for voicing concerns about workplace safety stemming from the fact that Apple's office building in Sunnyvale, California, is situated on top of an Environmental Protection Agency EPA designated Superfund site, an area contaminated by hazardous industrial waste that is supposed to have been cleaned up and contained if humans are in the vicinity. Giowick prevails, the NLRB could issue a ruling curtailing employers' abilities to surveil workers and chill their speech. Giowick has filed numerous other complaints with several environmental and workplace safety regulators and the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, and has been meticulous in documenting her experience as demonstrated by her personal website. This week, the Department of Labor ruled that Giowick's complaints had merit and that the agency's Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, would be investigating her whistleblower retaliation complaints. Whistleblowing law expert Stephen Kahn told the Financial Times that it was unusual for OSHA to investigate such allegations because companies often silence and intimidate employees and because those filing charges must establish that their case is likely to succeed. Most of us know that there is some level of pollution in our day-to-day lives, but there is still a lot of trust in the government and companies to do the right thing when it comes to poisoning people, she told Truth Out. In her NLRB complaint alleging illegal surveillance by Apple, Giowick cited the company's handbook, which reserves the right to search employees' work equipment and their personal devices to protect Apple confidential and sensitive information. The company defines its proprietary information to include compensation, training, recruiting, and other human resource information. Under federal labor law, all employees have the right to discuss their working conditions for the purpose of collective bargaining or other mutual aid or protection. The NLRB has ruled that management cannot spy on employees exercising their rights. The Apple handbook includes a footnote stating that the company is not attempting to restrict its employees' rights to speak freely about wages, hours, or working conditions as legally permitted. But Apple policy also generally forbids employees from making any public disclosures without prior approval, including statements to the press, and it orders employees to refrain from discussing compensation, training, recruiting, and other human resource information after leaving the company, which it attempts to enforce through non-disclosure agreements. The handbook also bars employees from sharing information about their co-workers' compensation, health information, or performance in disciplinary matters without any footnotes about rights to speak freely about wages, hours, or working conditions, according to Gilwick's complaint. Charges that Gilwick filed with NLRB also cite a memo circulated by Apple CEO Tim Cook after details of a meeting featuring discussion of pay equity was leaked to the press. Cook responded to the disclosure by vowing to identify those who leaked and by saying people who leak confidential information do not belong here, contradicting any stated policy granting employees the right to discuss their working conditions. Gilwick also told Truthout, when she informed someone on Apple's employee resources team that she had the legal right to speak publicly about working conditions, he replied, most people don't figure that out. In response to questions about Gilwick and Apple workplace activists, Apple has typically declined to make specific comments. For example, the company told Slate, "We are and have always been deeply committed to creating and maintaining a positive and inclusive workplace. We take all concerns seriously and we thoroughly investigate whenever a concern is raised and out of respect for the privacy of any individuals involved. We do not discuss specific employee matters." Apple has not responded to Truthout's request for comment on Gilwick's claim that a member of its employee resources team told her that the majority of Apple employees aren't aware of their rights in the workplace.
RIB English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Russian president has warned that Russia is prepared to take military technical measures in response to unfriendly Western actions over Ukraine. Now, Western governments accuse Moscow of planning to invade Ukraine, citing Russia's military buildup near the border. The Kremlin has rejected the claim and demands legal guarantees over its security from the U.S. and NATO. Putin says his country would be forced into a tough response unless the West dropped its aggressive line. In tonight's Spotlight, we'll discuss the growing tensions between Russia and the U.S. led NATO and their fallout for the world.
In recent weeks, tensions between Russia on one side and Ukraine and the U.S. led NATO on the other have reached an alarming new level, raising fears of an armed conflict. The two sides have time and time again accused each other of provoking a military escalation in Ukraine and warned of serious consequences. In the latest development, the Russian president has blamed the West for escalating tensions in Europe, citing NATO's eastward expansion and the U.S. withdrawal from missile treaties like the 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty and the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. Vladimir Putin says Washington's judgment has been clouded by euphoria after what he regarded as his victory in the Cold War. The Russian leader has also warned that his country is prepared to take military technical measures in response to unfriendly Western actions over Ukraine.
Russia stands for equal and indivisible security throughout the Eurasian area. Of course, as I have already noted, if our Western colleagues continue their aggressive course of action, we will take adequate military and technical actions in response. We will react toughly to unfriendly steps. And I want to emphasize, we have every right to do so. We have every right to take actions aimed at ensuring the security and sovereignty of Russia.
The warning comes as the U.S. and its European allies have stepped up their anti-Russia rhetoric under the pretext that Moscow is building up its troops to invade Ukraine. They have also warned Russia of consequences despite its repeated denial of any incursion plan. Russia argues that it's the U.S. and NATO that are infringing upon it with an eastward expansion and by arming Ukraine under false excuses. Russia has also demanded legal security guarantees regarding the situation around Ukraine. In the draft security pacts published on Friday, Russia urged NATO to give up any military activity in Eastern Europe and Ukraine and roll back the deployment of its troops and weapons. The documents also call for a ban on sending both U.S. and Russian warships and aircrafts to areas from where they can attack each other's territory. In addition, the documents demand a halt to NATO's military drills near Russia's borders. However, many experts have cast doubt on the possibility of reaching an agreement between the U.S. and Russia, saying even if Washington accepts such terms, there is still no guarantee that it remains committed to them.
If we look at it contemporarily, U.S. promises and guarantees and even signed treaties and negotiations mean nothing. I mean, Iran knows this with the JCPOA, the different nuclear treaties which have been violated by the United States unilaterally. So these are worthless, and I doubt that they will actually make any agreement.
The United States, especially under the presidency of Joe Biden, has made its best efforts to provide military support to Ukraine, which lies on Russia's doorstep. In September, Washington signed a new cooperation agreement in the field of defense and security with Kiev. In the meantime, the U.S. is training military personnel in the Eastern European country, upgrading the country's ports to fit its warships and supplying it annually with hundreds of millions of dollars in military aid. The Biden administration's policies show that Washington is trying to keep tensions escalating to reduce Russia's influence in Eastern Europe, and Ukraine seems to be the best place to aim this goal. Russia, on the other hand, argues that while Ukraine is free to decide the security arrangements, those cannot threaten Russia's interests and security, insisting that Ukraine joining the NATO military alliance would cross a red line. As tensions between Russia and NATO over Ukraine are escalating, there are serious concerns about the potential for military escalation, potentially to the point of full-blown war.
Now, welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let's see who's joining us in this episode. Independent analyst Tim Kirby is in Moscow. Also, journalist and political commentator Jim Cavanaugh is joining us out of New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Now, let me turn to Tim. Russian President Vladimir Putin said just a few hours ago that what the U.S., I'm quoting him, what the U.S. is doing in Ukraine is at our doorstep, and they should understand that we have nowhere further to retreat to. So, Tim, what do you make of Putin's sentence when he says that Russia has no other place to retreat to?
That may be in reference to some of the silliness regarding the location of Russian troops within Russia. Because they keep receiving warnings from Washington that Russia needs to pull back its troops, pull them back. Well, to where? Russian territory. There's essentially Russia really, from within itself, also in a more abstract sense, feels that it really can't give up any more than it's already given up, especially during the break of the Soviet Union. So that's essentially the logic.
Okay. And Jim, Putin also says that Western countries are arming and urging an extremist from a neighboring country at Russia. Do you think we'll just watch idly? That's his question. So will just Russia stand idly by and see what's happening along its borders?
You know, Putin has been saying this for years. There are videos that from 2016, 17, 18, where he's talking to Western press and he's saying, you are not reporting what's happening. This is very dangerous. Tensions are escalating. And this has been going on for years. And, you know, the United States promised not to move an inch closer to Russia, to move NATO an inch to the east after the breakup of the Soviet Union. They broke that promise. And, you know, Putin has been saying we cannot allow a military infrastructure, missiles that can reach our homeland in 5, 10 minutes to approach our borders. And now you have a situation in Ukraine where, you know, the accession of Ukraine to NATO has been saying for a long time is a red line. Even the planting of what he calls the infrastructure of NATO into Ukraine, which is actually happening. In other words, they're being integrated in everything but name only. There are American soldiers in Ukraine, and there are American mercenaries in Ukraine, and they're there to act as tripwires in case anything happens. And you have the vision of Ukraine, which is really the nut problem here. You have fascist forces in Western Ukraine backing the Kiev government. They want to take the Donbas regions back, Donetsk and Lugansk. There's an agreement, a Minsk agreement, that was negotiated in 2015. They don't want to abide by it because that would require giving those regions some kind of political autonomy. So really, this whole brouhaha about Russia's going to invade Ukraine is really, they're getting ready, I believe, to make an offensive against eastern Ukraine to take it back. And they don't want Russia to come in and prevent that, which Russia would do. And I think that probably would do. I can't speak Russian, but I think the buildup on the border is partly about that. It's saying to the West, don't try and, you know, use these because the Ukrainian army can't do anything by itself. It's going to need the help of NATO and the United States. And that's what Russia is saying. Stay out of this. You know, do not. We don't want to see. Russia doesn't want to invade Ukraine and take over Ukraine. There's no reason for that. But they will not allow, I don't think, the Kiev regime to come back and attack the eastern, the Donbas region.
Okay. Now, Tim, Putin also has been warning the U.S. and NATO against stoking tensions near the Russian borders. But this was the first time that he explicitly talked about a potential military conflict and, in his words, appropriate retaliatory military technical measures. So what do you make of his tone this time and the fact that he was addressing Russian defense ministry officials?
Well, it's definitely a warning that he means business. We shouldn't forget that during the Maidan crisis and the Ukraine turned into a revolution, and the breakaway of the Crimea, that was really a flashpoint moment where, when the Crimea left, it could have actually caused World War III. And we have to keep cool heads. And I think Putin was just wanted to make a clear reminder that, like, look, if you try to betray us, if you try to make some sort of sneaky business, we're going to go in and we're going to do something. You know, basically saying that let's not play chicken, let's not play games, let's all get out of this alive and well.
Now, Jim, what Moscow wants, and it has actually outlined these as red lines, are, you know, a set of security guarantees from the West, including denying NATO membership for Ukraine, withdrawal of U.S. and NATO troops from Eastern Europe. So would the U.S. accept these or not? And because, you know, there are arguments that rejecting these demands would risk closing off any space for dialogue and further escalating the crisis.
That's exactly right. I mean, you know, but these are the kinds of things that would have been standard procedure in the age of détente. You know, when the United States and Russia were actually making agreements with each other. And what's happened now is the political atmosphere in the United States is so toxic about this that it's very difficult for anybody to do that, for the president to do that. The Russophobia is rampant among the Republicans and Democrats. And you have, you know, as Putin said, and as everybody knows, the United States abrogated and broke treaties. It replaced, essentially, since during the Yeltsin period, from essentially the Yugoslavia to Libya, the United States was able to do anything it wanted militarily in the world, and Russia would not stand in its way. That changed, starting with Ukraine and Syria. And now you have a situation where Russia is saying, let's have agreements where everybody backs off, where we agree to not station troops here, to not put this kind of military equipment here. These are reasonable things. But the United States has gotten used to having its way. And and the political atmosphere in the United States now is really toxic in the sense that, you know, everybody wants, literally, the majority of Democrats are ready to go to war with Russia over Ukraine. And so, you know, it's going to be very hard for an American president to make agreements with Russia and not be characterized as being weak, being soft on Russia, giving things up, et cetera. So it's a very difficult political situation.
Mm-hmm. And Tim, how do you think Washington would have reacted if Moscow had done the same and deployed massive military equipment and troops on the U.S. doorsteps? And
well,
if you remember
the
two countries, you know,
the Cold War was called the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Exactly.
Of course, they absolutely freaked out and went completely insane, which we can understand because having nuclear missiles that close to U.S. territory was terrifying. But at the same time, the nuclear missiles that NATO was able to get into Turkey during the Cold War that were relatively just as effective, that went rather silent. So I imagine that the situation would really resemble the Cuban Missile Crisis in terms of scale. However, we're in the 21st century, and that scale would include a lot more social media.
Okay. And Jim, do you also believe that what's happening on Russia's border is similar to 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis?
Yes, very much so. And those missiles in Turkey, there was an agreement made silently. The Americans didn't admit it explicitly, but Kennedy agreed and later took those missiles out of Turkey. But he wouldn't do it explicitly. He couldn't make that concession explicitly. But even more than that, I want to go back to the Bay of Pigs, because what you had there, this is the point. We have wild card actors here. We have these fascist forces in Ukraine that are pushing, and they're being given rhetorical and military support by the United States, and they may think, like the CIA did at the Bay of Pigs, well, if we go do that, we're going to force the president's hand. He's going to have to come support us. And they may think if we go attack Donbass, well, NATO is going to have to come support us. And that's why you have a very dangerous situation, because there are wild cards in this situation that can, you know, make things happen that nobody really wants to have happen.
Right. And Tim, what message was the U.S. sending when it simply quit the Open Skies Treaty and also the INF? You know, Russia's already warned that it might redeploy intermediate-range nuclear missiles in Europe, and that in response to what it sees as NATO's expansion toward its borders.
Now, about these agreements, one thing we have to remember is that when we look at agreements between people, we tend to look at them from our own individualistic standpoint. But when you sort of look at them in a real politic, might makes right sort of dynamic, you can see that even if something is written on paper, the broken, impoverished former Soviet Union really wasn't in any position to enforce, especially during the Yeltsin period, any particular agreements that it would have had with Washington, even if Washington would have put a lot of things in writing that it didn't. So, and with some of the other treaties about missiles and how they've been violated, essentially it's really a matter of power dynamics because between forces that actually can exert power onto each other, you know, between two actors in foreign relations, you can have a treaty, you can have an agreement, especially if both sides are monitoring each other. The islands of Fiji, could they really enforce a treaty on Washington? Of course not. They have no means to. Mm-hmm. And the Russia of the 90s and sort of early 2000s was unable to. But current Russia seems to be able to. It would seem that things are changing. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the most important dynamics for this entire new agreement process is the real big question is, does Washington see itself as still being this global hegemon and a monopolar world order where it's trying to make a continue a Pax Americana that doesn't have much Pax in it, right? Or has it, like some generals and other people have sort of admitted, starting to see itself in sort of a multipolar, at least tripolar world, and it might be willing to negotiate in that context? And that's really the most important factor, how Washington sees itself and its own future. That'll really determine how all this goes.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jim, you know that the West has said that we want dialogue with Russia, a meaningful one, in their words, and also on the basis of reciprocity. And that's what Moscow also had asked for, direct negotiations. So what do you think could come out of this?
Well, you know, these are nice principles that everybody enunciates. But as Tim is saying, you know, in not just the power dynamics militarily, but also the political dynamics are you know, very strong here. And there's going to be so much resistance to anything that can be characterized as a concession to Russia. The United States got used during that Yeltsin period from Yugoslavia to Libya of getting anything it wanted, of being a unipolar actor and of replacing essentially the international system based on the United Nations with its own notion of the international community, which was essentially itself and its allies. And they don't want to go back to that. And what's happening in with Russia and countries like China and Iran is that they have met, you know, they've built up enough strength, certainly in their own regions, to now be able to resist American absolute hegemony. And the Americans have to decide, American elite has to decide whether it's willing to concede that it no longer has absolute hegemony in these regions, or whether it's not going to allow that process to continue, that process of its own weakening hegemony to continue, and it's going to reassert absolute hegemony. And that's the decision that the United States has to make here in Ukraine and in Eastern Europe and in its relations with Russia. And the political dynamic behind that in the United States, I'm afraid, is very bad.
And Tim, what kind of prospect would you see regarding these negotiations, given the divisions inside NATO and the U.S. also has its issues with it? So would they come to an agreement? Because they're talking about probability of reaching an understanding.
Well, the probability of that really, again, depends on how, like I just said, Washington sees itself. If Washington sees itself, again, as being the monopolar world, the center of everything, then essentially this is all just basically a big dog and pony show. And they're going to, as they have sort of traditionally, generally it's sanctions really put pressure on Russia and then offer Russia some sort of trinkets to maybe get out of this bad situation. Mm-hmm. Essentially, take six steps from the Russians and offer them one or two back. That's the usual MO over the last 30 years. If Washington does see itself as part of a multipolar world, the deal that the Russians have offered of basically giving them more or less the territory of the Soviet Union back is actually a pretty good deal, because if you look on a map, That gives then NATO or Washington pretty much the entirety of Europe. And if Washington also were to be smart about this, it would be a good time to negotiate where Russia's foreign influence can reach at its maximum. Russia does not have that many foreign bases or foreign influence, and they could really lock the Russians into a deal that keeps Russia mostly trapped within, deep within the Eurasian landmass, and with, I believe there's a base in Vietnam, forgive me, my memory doesn't serve very well sometimes. There's, of course, bases now in Syria and maybe one in Africa, and just keep it at that. And that would really keep the Russians locked into a position. However, the Russians would jump at that type of deal and would be thrilled by it. I think it would make both sides happy. But again, that's only if Washington sees itself as having to deal with having the Russians and the Chinese as political actors for the foreseeable future, and just accept that we've entered a multipolar world, which there's no guarantee of that.
And one last question for Jim, and that's what you see on the horizon as regards security in Europe and beyond, given the Ukraine issue.
It's very difficult. You know, it's to Russians today, I believe, start to cut gas supplies to Europe. You know, they hope it's the Europeans really who are in at the center of this and are going to kill themselves with this in every way. Russia has tremendous economic power over Europe, and certainly in any military conflict, Europe's going to be the first to go. The Russians are going to go after those missile emplacements in Europe. And so I don't, you know, I'm not sanguine about this. I think that Ukraine, again, there's these other political actors in Ukraine who can push this issue in a way that traps everybody in a situation that's very bad. So I don't see the political dynamic or the political will in the United States to actually sit down and treat Russia as a peer and as some, you know, to essentially what was wrong with the INF treaty, with the internet, with the anti-ABM treaty? These were good things. What really Russia is asking for, let's effectively reconstitute those things in some way or another. The United States pulled out of them because they thought they could get a unilateral advantage, and I don't think they've given up on that.
Okay, and then we'll come to the end of this show. Thank you, my guests, independent analysts Tim Kirby in Moscow, journalist and political commentator Jim Kavanagh in New York. And I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi. I'll see you next time.